Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how funding cuts and economic uncertainty are affecting charitable giving and how the heat impacts us on a cellular level. But first, President Trump last month signed an executive order that called for building new housing on federal land. Arizona and many parts of the country are facing severe housing shortages, and supporters say opening up these lands to development could help. With me to talk about the potential impact of this proposal is Alex Horowitz, Director of Housing Policy at the Pew Charitable Trust. And Alex, let's start with some of the reasons why this might be a good idea to help alleviate some of the housing shortage.
So all federal land is not created equal. As an example, there are post offices in towns and cities throughout the country. And so that's an example of federal land where there's a real opportunity for people to be close to the places they go every day. And so to improve walkability, to decrease traffic, to help people have short commutes. And turning over parcels like that or adding housing on top of post offices or instead of them in some places can be a great use of existing federal land, because we see that the primary driver for residents is location. And people are getting priced out of communities. And as they seek out lower housing costs, they often end up with higher transportation costs. So infill parcels like post offices and like federal office buildings, which may be underused, or pockets of land in existing cities and town can be a great opportunity to add housing where it's needed most.
So when you talk about not all federal land is sort of created equally, I assume this sort of leads to one of the concerns, which is that a lot of this federal land is not in places where people do live or necessarily want to live. It's kind of out, like away from other population centers, business centers, things like that.
That's right. So most federal land is not suitable for housing. And in fact, we're talking about a very small portion that would be suitable. And there are really four reasons why. One is a lack of infrastructure. So a lack of roads, sewer, water, electrical, internet. So the infrastructure is just not in place. Second is that if the housing is far away from the places people go every day, that can put a real strain on household budgets because it drives up transportation costs as people put more miles on cars. They spend more on gas. A third problem here is that with existing federal land being where it is, the time that people spend to get there can mean that there just aren't enough hours in the day. A lot of people are trying to shrink their commutes rather than increase them. And the last one is that homeowners insurance keeps going up every year. And part of that is because some new housing is built in fire-prone areas, in flood-prone areas. And so it's very possible to see your insurance costs rise as you live farther and farther from established cities and towns.
Is there a concern also about what this federal land is used for other than potentially housing? Like if it's environmentally sensitive, or maybe it's, you know, there's some other use for it. It's a recreation area, things like that, that might be lost if you develop it?
Well, that's a possibility too, but my focus is really on housing in this work. And so the affordability and availability of housing, look, I need to acknowledge, absolutely, there could be trade-offs if you're not using land for other purposes and you're using it for housing instead. But even as housing, this land that is far from cities and towns is usually not very well suited to housing, because we see the most demand and the greatest shortage is housing that is near jobs, that's near schools, that's near commerce.
So given that, as you say, a lot of this federal land is not necessarily suitable for housing, assuming that the Trump administration goes ahead with this, how big of a dent do you think this could put in the housing shortage we're dealing with?
Because of location issues and infrastructure issues, this does not look like a primary solution to America's housing shortage. And that's a shame, because America's housing shortage is immense. The U.S. is short between 4 and 7 million homes, and there are real promising solutions to making a difference and to ending that shortage. As examples, permitting reform, land use reform to make it easier to build starter homes, to make it easier to build apartments, building code reforms to make it less expensive to build. All of those have a proven track record. Whereas this idea of using land that is for the most part far flung hasn't really been tried before with a lot of success. And so the more promising approaches for transferring federal land look like they're about infill.
So when you're looking at, for example, maybe converting a post office or some other federal building into housing, if it's infill, are you envisioning, or maybe would it be ideal to have that as more multifamily housing as opposed to single family housing in those spaces?
That's usually the case. And we see that overall, the shortage of multifamily housing is probably even larger than the shortage of single family housing. So enabling more multifamily housing can be a good way for seniors to downsize who want to, and to open up opportunities so that people can live closer to jobs and that they can access amenities and schools. So multifamily housing is a strong solution for that problem.
When you're looking at more infill or even closer in land that maybe hasn't been developed before, I wonder if maybe like city or municipal land or state land might be a better place for governments to be looking if public entities are looking to turn their land into housing.
We need an all-of-the-above approach. Our housing shortage is just that severe. So city land, state land, federal land that's in existing cities and towns, absolutely. All of those should be on the table.
So given sort of all the pros and cons of using federal land for housing, as we've talked about, on balance, is it worth it for the Trump administration, do you think, to pursue this strategy?
Well, look, whether it's a city government, a state government, or the federal government, it's absolutely worth cataloging land that is unoccupied and would place people near opportunity where there's the most demand to live. So that can mean vacant office buildings. It can mean parcels that are unused. Parking lots are often something that just remains as parking for a long time, even though they are underused, especially with reduced commuting. So it's absolutely worth cataloging buildings and parcels that are in high demand places, because part of the goal here is to improve household budgets overall. And with half of renters spending more than 30% of income on rent, with home prices near an all-time high, households need all the help they can get. But that means that we've got to consider their transportation costs too, so that they need to be able to live closer to the places that they travel most often, so we don't create more traffic and we don't create more strain on their budgets.
All right. That is Alex Horowitz, director of the Pew Charitable Trust Housing Policy Initiative. Alex, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Today is Arizona Gives Day, a 24-hour fundraising sprint for nonprofits of every size and cause. So far today, those groups have raised more than $1 million combined. Since 2013, the day has brought in more than $47 million. For some of those nonprofits, donations may take on more importance as federal funding is cut or in doubt. There are also questions about whether the country is headed for a recession, which could impact philanthropy as well. With me to talk more about this is Marsha Mintz, CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of the Valley, which is one of the organizations to whom donors can contribute today. Marsha, good morning.
Good morning.
So how important to you and your organization is this one day?
You know, it's a really important day for our organization and all nonprofits, as you know, we rely more heavily on individual giving right now, and it's a perfect opportunity for donors at any level to contribute and support the nonprofits they care about.
When you say you rely more on individual donors, is that sort of in as opposed to more corporate donors?
Correct. I think that right now the landscape is showing, you know, in Arizona, particularly youth serving organizations, we saw the steepest decline in individual giving in the last year. It's over 13.8% decline. And that's significant for us because of our heavy reliance on individual donors.
Why do you think that happened?
You know, I think there's a lot of reasons that happen. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now, you know, given the landscape about shifting federal priorities. And I think the impact on what's happening is causing a little bit of a delay for individual donors as well as corporate donors from giving when they normally give at this time. I'm hoping that changes and people will feel more comfortable in the future, but there has definitely been a shift and a decline.
How much do you find the donors are paying attention to the economy? I mean, we've heard so much about tariffs and prices going up and, you know, just recently over the last few days, more predictions of there being a recession later this year. How much does that impact you?
It impacts us significantly because I think donors are very aware of what's happening and, you know, they have to monitor their finances and resources just the same way businesses do. So it's not that donors are saying no, they may be saying, let me wait a little bit. But those dollars that we receive on an ongoing basis really could and will stop services if the funds don't flow through.
I'm also curious about the impact of federal funding. So many causes and organizations around the country have seen their funding either reduced or cut altogether. What's the situation for Boys and Girls Clubs?
You know, I think that we are monitoring the situation, I can say, on a daily basis. We are definitely concerned about the uncertainty that's going to happen. You know, we're halfway into our fiscal year, so we're monitoring it very carefully and causing us to have, you know, different plans and contingency plans. The worst case scenario being that we would actually have to eliminate certain services. You know, we provide 800,000 meals a year that relies on our federal food program. So there are programs like that we will monitor very closely, as well as our after school, our out of school time programming, our 21st century funding. If that does go away, it would lead to an elimination of services.
How does all of this affect the messaging that you put out into the community and to prospective donors?
I think that it's really important, certainly for us as well as other nonprofits, to be communicating more than ever with individual and corporate donors, sharing with them what's happening, the potential impact, and really asking them to step up, especially today on Arizona Gives Day. But also there's the tax credit program, and everybody still has till April 15th to make that tax credit and get that money right back. But that those dollars go directly to organizations like ours who really rely on those funds.
Is there a balance that you have to strike between maybe raising awareness of some of the programs, as you referenced, that might have to go away if funding doesn't come through, while at the same time not sort of being seen as crying wolf?
Absolutely. And we're very careful with our messaging and letting our donors know the truth is if that funding continues, the more money we raise, the more youth we get to serve. So there, it's a win-win for us in terms of, yes, we have to diversify our revenue. And so does every nonprofit. You know, as much as we, you know, as much as we can get from individual donors, corporate donors, foundations, as well as federal funding, just helps us serve more kids. We're just limited in our capacity by the dollars we can raise. So if we raise additional dollars, we serve more kids. And if we can't, then we serve less kids.
How is what you're seeing now and maybe what you're looking at into the near future, how does that compare with what you saw during the COVID era?
You know, COVID was very different. COVID, I felt, was the community really came together and stepped up because it affected everybody. It was kind of the equalizer. It didn't matter what your situation was. Everybody was dealing with the same thing. Our organization was very lucky. We had donors really step up. We were the first youth serving organization to stay open and primarily supported essential workers and healthcare workers, frontline workers. So donors came out in droves. And I think both from an individual, a corporate, a foundation standpoint, and even, you know, federal support, we actually did not receive a tremendous amount of federal support because we had incredible support from the local community because we were staying open. We were not closed and we were serving families and kids every single day. So I think what's different now is everybody's in a situation of wait and see, and that sense of uncertainty. Absolutely. You know, this is not a crisis. This is a change in policy, and that's okay. It's just a long-term change and people need more information so they can make informed decisions, even nonprofits. You know, we can't change our business plan, you know, every day. We're waiting to understand what the impacts of the policies are. And I think individual donors and families, corporations and foundations are doing the same.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Marcia Mintz, CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of the Valley. Marcia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, local chefs are bringing taste education to classrooms.
I was just so excited to go back. I mean, I'm passionate about food. I'm passionate about cooking. And then to have this opportunity to share it with younger people is just, I think it's great. It's a win.
We'll hear more about the vision of the Blue Watermelon Project. But first, it may be April Fool's Day, and the weather today feels like a bit of a prank. It's unseasonably cool out, and as we're all painfully aware, generally speaking, heat in the valley is no joke, even in what the rest of the country might call springtime. The danger of heat-induced catastrophic incidents is well documented, from heat stroke to wildfires. But our next guest wanted to study the longer-term effects of heat on the human body. What exactly does it do to a person to spend as much time as we Valley residents do living in extreme temperatures? Anyoung Choi is a postdoctoral researcher at USC, and in a recent study, she and her team looked at the ways extreme heat affects people on a cellular level. She spoke with my co-host, Sam Dingman.
We thought that this is an important gap in the literature because the physical toll of heat might not show up right away as a diagnosable health condition, but they could be taking a silent toll at the molecular or the cellular level in our body.
So tell us what the results of your study suggest about that. What is happening to our cells when we spend extended periods of time in extreme heat?
So yeah, our study essentially find a significant association between neighborhoods with more days of extreme heat and older biological age, comparable to the effects seen with smoking and heavy alcohol consumption, the two well-established risk factors for accelerating aging. So for example, we found that residents in places where extreme heat events happening for near half of the year, such as Phoenix, experienced up to 14 months of additional biological aging compared to those living in much cooler areas with fewer than 10 heat days per year, such as in Seattle. What's important is that this association that we find remained even after controlling for a lot of other individual and community level differences, such as income, education, race, ethnicity, physical activity, smoking and alcohol use, all factors that could otherwise explain differences in aging.
Wow. So it really is, it's the heat that is aging the cells more quickly. Can you talk a little bit about what the downstream effects on someone's physiology, on their health might be as a result of having their cells age faster? Like, what could that lead to?
There is a growing body of literature suggesting that this acceleration can lead to development of chronic conditions such as cardiovascular disease or even early death.
Obviously, what you're describing for a lot of folks listening to this could conceivably be a little terrifying. Just this idea that by virtue of living in a place like Phoenix, where it is extraordinarily hot, without doing anything else potentially that could be bad for your health, you're just existing somewhere where it's making your body age faster. Are there steps that eventually people living in environments like Phoenix could one day take that would counteract this at all?
Yeah, so there are two points that I really want to mention regarding your question. First, our study suggests that it's chronic heat exposure, not the like just several months of exposure. Uh-huh. So one definite way to prevent this adverse health impact is definitely prevent repeated exposure that happening to people. But also, second thing is our study really looks at the overall local heat level heat exposure, so that our findings don't really mean that every person living in Phoenix has an older biological age, but rather it's just average. And there are many factors at play, and some individuals may be more resilient or have ways to reduce their heat exposure. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely the area where more research is needed. But we can't just tell people pack up and move to somewhere cooler, right?
Yeah.
So that's really why we need to be thinking about age-appropriate mitigation strategy we really think that we can't just focus on individual solutions. We need to think about how we design our neighborhoods more heat resilient. Mm-hmm. So even simple changes to neighborhood design can make a big impact, like adding shade to bus stops so that older adults can sit down with shade. Like such a simple interventions like these can be life-saving for especially vulnerable population like older adults.
Yeah. Well, so obviously you've just published this study that has these really remarkable findings about the effects on epigenetic aging of chronic heat exposure. And I know you're actually planning to move here to Phoenix later this year, presumably to continue this research. What do you feel is the next step?
One of our biggest priorities is understanding why some people are more affected than others. Right now, we've looked at shorter time frames, but we need to really understand the long-term effects that heat exposure from early life, for example, even accelerate aging over decades. Are there any critical windows? Does the damage build up over time? Like more importantly, I think that I want to focus on some why all this like answering scientific question, I want to do more community engaged work so that like raise the awareness among nursing home residents so that we can work together to like educate people and empower people.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking, oh my God, like, what do I do? It's summer is coming. I mean, we know that things like stress are bad for our bodies. Smoking, lack of sleep, excessive alcohol consumption, these sorts of things. Does your research so far suggest that those things are extra dangerous when one lives in chronic heat?
So our study didn't explore that, but we know a lot from other environmental exposure literature, like air pollution, that if you're living in really highly polluted areas, and if you feel a lot of stress from like highly disadvantaged your neighborhood or like bad health behaviors, then those are the most vulnerable population. So in addition to this well-known risk factor, if you also live in very hot area, there are potentially this compounding impact on your body.
Well, we will look forward to having you back on as your studies continue, because it's only getting hotter here in Phoenix, as you're about to find out. Eunyoung Choi is a postdoctoral researcher at USC. And Eunyoung, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this work.
Thank you, Sam. This was very, very exciting.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. And now let's turn to my co-host Lauren Gilger in a conversation about bias in schools against a population you might not have considered before.
We know that kids of color have worse outcomes in school in America, and kids in low-income areas, and kids who don't speak English as their first language. But what about kids with childhood obesity? Well, our next guest is one of the few people who has looked into this growing population and says their education outcomes are way worse than every other group. It's a problem that affects 15 million children, and the pandemic only made it worse. Kavitha Cardoza is a journalist for the Hechinger Report, who's been writing about childhood obesity for years. I spoke with her more about what she found.
They're more likely to get lower grades in reading and math, to repeat a grade. They're twice as likely to be placed in special ed or remedial classes. They're also significantly more likely to miss school, to be suspended, receive detention, and they're less likely to enter and to graduate from college.
Wow. Okay. So really big differences here. And you also found in your reporting that they're often treated differently in schools. Tell us, you know, what often happens?
I think it's very unconscious on the part of teachers. At least I like hope so. But I think we all have this kind of unconscious bias against people with obesity. And the kind of thinking is, if you don't want to be treated like this, you should lose weight, as if it's something under our control. Mm. And it really isn't. It's such a complex disease, and it's made up of genetics and hormones and economics and the environment and so many different factors. And so children really have a hard time. They're treated differently both by their peers and by teachers. I profile so many children with obesity, and they had no idea what the research said, Lauren.
Right.
It mirrored exactly what the research said.
Over and over. Wow. So tell us about some of those students. You profile, for example, a student in the piece named Stephanie, whose last name you're withholding to protect her privacy. Tell us about what happened to her in school.
She is Hispanic. And so in her family, she says, no one ever said anything. She was called, like, always thought of as very cute. Her parents doted on her. And she went to school. As early as kindergarten, she started being called a Teletubby. And then after that, she noticed, like, when someone brought in cupcakes for their birthday, the teacher would say, well, are you sure you want a slice of that? Like, why don't you eat the carrots instead? So it was one of those things where she didn't want to eat in school. She didn't want to be around other kids. And I think what particularly hurt her is she said that she was taught and told from a very young age, if you ever need help, if you're ever upset, go find a teacher. They'll be on your side. Right. But in this case, she found that that wasn't true. She kept telling me through the interview how she felt like a shadow. And she said she would put her hand up to answer questions and the teacher wouldn't call her, even though she was the only one with her hand up.
Wow.
Or she wasn't chosen for things. This came up several times with Stephanie and other kids, you know. They were not chosen for the drama. They were not chosen to be in the robotics club. They were not chosen. It was as if teachers didn't see them or thought that they were not capable. And one time was just devastating to her. She went up to the front of the classroom to ask the teacher a question after class. And the teacher said, hey, are you a new student? And she said,
wow.
I've been here the whole year. I've been submitting classwork like every day. Like, how can you not have seen me? And she said, that was the point at which, I think she was in the seventh grade, she said she'd stopped caring about grades.
Wow. So that, yeah, I mean, you can see the direct impact on her to her educational outcomes. And it's not just kids teasing, which you might expect. It's the way teachers mm-hmm. and staff treat kids like this, too. Is there any training, Kavitha, for teachers, for school staff about this?
It's really disappointing, Lauren, but there isn't. Every school district, every school really has an anti-bullying policy. And, you know, there it's explicitly mentioned and teachers receive training on you can't discriminate on the basis of race or gender or sexual orientation or national origin. Or, you know, right. We have a lot of protections and teachers are trained on a lot of those things. They are not trained on weight. And in some ways, that kind of mirrors our society where there are legal protections for all those other identities, but not for weight. You can legally discriminate on the basis of weight.
Mm. And so there's no training, there's no protections for kids like that. Is there, in your reporting on this, is there talk of solutions?
We're not sure how effective it is, but one study found that it was effective, and that was to include weight. You know, you have teacher training for all these other kind of categories. Include weight. And some school districts do have appearance, but mm-hmm. researchers found that is not enough. Mm. And then everyone is more likely to kind of get on board and even realize that they're doing it. A lot of times it's unconscious with teachers because, you know, our society is so, we have this unconscious bias about weight, and right. we're only starting to change that.
Right. Like, that solution is almost so simple you don't think of it. Like, let's talk then about the context that this is happening in, right? Like, we are much more aware of, at least it seems, of childhood obesity, of obesity in general as an issue. There's much more conversation around it today and what it means and discrimination against it. Has behavior gotten any better on a broader scale? Why hasn't that been reflected in what's happening to kids?
Actually, I have to say that with kids, childhood obesity has steadily been increasing over the past 50 years, and so has weight bias. Mm. It's one of those things where you've seen other biases, like racial bias and things like that, go down, but you have not seen discrimination on the basis of weight go down. And I think now, because of drugs like Ozempic, there's even more of a sense almost that, well, you could just take a tablet or you could just take a shot and you could cure this. And it's kind of really not understanding what the situation is. Mm. There are all kinds of factors that, one, these drugs are not approved for children and teens. Bariatric surgery, which the child I interviewed, Stephanie, had when she was 18, but you have to take nutritional supplements all your life, you know, so if you're kind of low income, if you're not in a stable household, like those are not avenues you can go down if you don't have insurance, and it's a major surgery. So right. I'm not saying like those are not solutions. I've spoken to several doctors who really advocate for it. The Association of Pediatricians came out and said, like, children should be given the option of surgery when they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. But it really is something to carefully consider. But really, the eat less and exercise more, I mean, if it worked, then adults would do it easily, right? And we know how hard it is. Why do we think it's easier for children, especially when they're not the ones cooking food, grocery shopping, you know, deciding what's on the school lunch menu? They have no control over any of that.
Right. And does some of this point to a larger problem, like a societal problem, just in terms of access to good foods, poverty?
Absolutely. It's a much, much bigger problem. Mm. I was at a grocery store once and I was speaking to a mother, and she had a lot of shelf-stable foods.
Right.
And she said she was in a low-income neighborhood. She said, I can't afford to buy food that my children won't eat.
Mm.
Lauren, that just stopped me in my tracks because... Yeah. You know, if you're upper middle class, it's very easy to say, oh, try different foods. You can't do that if you don't have money or you don't have that disposable income. Yeah. And so it's way more complex.
Yeah. Kavitha Cardoza, a journalist for the Hechinger Report, joining us to talk more about her reporting on childhood obesity and educational outcomes. Kavitha, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Lauren.
When it comes to childhood obesity, there's one trailblazer here in Arizona trying to change the conversation around it. Charlene Badman, the James Beard Award-winning chef behind F&B in Scottsdale. Since 2016, she's been going to schools teaching kids about food. It's called the Blue Watermelon Project. That's a group of students at Echo Canyon School making amaranth pancakes with all the toppings with Chef Badman on a recent Monday afternoon.
Can you help me with this? All right. Do you want to start whisking? We're a group of chefs, volunteers, farmers, advocates, educators, principals and teachers. You know, it's taste education.
The kids are mixing, chopping, whipping their reward after harvesting the key ingredient they grew themselves right there on school grounds.
They were able to see their amaranth grow. They planted it in September. We harvested some today. They're now having pancakes. They're going to be able to taste what they planted.
But do they like their healthier than your average pancakes and whipped cream?
Is it good, you guys?
Maybe. One thing I kind of don't like is that the whipped cream kind of tastes a little like water.
There's no sugar in it, probably, huh?
You happy?
Yeah.
Okay.
No way. That's good. It's
nothing will make me more happy.
That's bomb.
You like yours. All right. Good, good.
But liking the food is not the point, as Badman told me when she came into our studios to talk more about it.
I started originally when we first opened the restaurant going to one school. It was Arcadia Neighborhood Learning Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they had asked me to come and do a chef in the garden. And they had this beautiful garden. They wanted to use the produce. They wanted to have the students be able to see it being used, and thought the opportunity of having a chef come in would be really great for the students. But after doing that first one, I just loved it. I wanted to come back. And so I kept going back. And when I say it started in 2016, by then it's when I really saw that I wanted to take this opportunity I had with one school and do it in multiple schools.
And it's gotten much bigger since then, right?
It is. This year, we're in 35 schools. Next year, 50 schools.
Wow. And you work with chefs all over the state as well.
We do. And it's so many chefs that have been able to, they've just stepped up and have become part of what we're trying to do, the movement of getting an opportunity for students to try fresh food and also to know where it comes from.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why this resonated with you so much when you went to that first school to do the first version of this, right? I mean, are you like a kid person? Was this about the kids for you? Was that surprising to you that you enjoyed it so much?
It was surprising. I enjoyed it so much because I had told the vice principal who invited me, you know, I don't like children, and but I'm going to do this. And then I felt how great it felt. I saw the difference I was making like immediately and the opportunity and the joy it brought the students. Mm. And I was just so excited to go back. I mean, I'm passionate about food. I'm passionate about cooking. And then to have this opportunity to share it with younger people is just, I think it's great. It's a win.
What kind of reactions have you gotten from kids? Like, do they, how foreign is the idea of growing a garden and harvesting it and cooking with that food to these kids?
All sorts of reactions. I've recently had a six-year-old say, I don't eat plants, and she wasn't going to participate. They will tell you they're not going to eat things. They're not going to eat what you brought. And then there are others that are excited about it. And we don't ever tell them they're going to have to eat this or you got to take that try it bite. Obviously, I want them to try it. But if they don't want to, it's OK. And often they see how excited their friends are about it and they're like, OK, I'll try it.
Yeah. What are your memories of food when you were a kid? Like, were you exposed to fresh foods as a young kid?
Not a whole lot. It just wasn't something we had. When I went to visit my grandparents that lived in California, we had a lot. They had a garden. My grandmother had come from a farm. She always made sure she had a garden. They had a macadamia nut tree. They had avocado tree. They had all these beautiful things in the backyard. I can tell you that I definitely didn't appreciate them. I was definitely the child that was saying, I don't want to eat these things.
Sure.
And I just wish, I look back at that memory and wish I would have been more appreciative of what they were trying to offer. Because, you know, they had really some of the best food.
Hmm. So you grew to be not just a chef, but a chef who's really famous for the way you work with vegetables in particular. How did that transformation happen for you?
It happened while having F&B in the last 15 years. It happened with the fact that I changed my eating habits and I changed what I like to eat. I think that successful chefs, they cook what they enjoy. And I enjoy eating vegetables and I enjoy coming up with different ways to flavor them and different ways to prepare them. And I think that was my own kind of personal journey of changing the way I ate and then putting that into how I cook today.
Yeah. Is this for you about nutrition for kids? Is it about making kids healthier? Is it about the food and just exposing them to it?
I think it's all of those things. I think that, you know, it is about having better eating habits. It definitely is about maybe trying something that they've never had before, being excited about fruits and vegetables, being excited about food. And then I think it translates into maybe them with that exposure that we're able to give them, maybe having them open up to trying more things like, say, in the cafeteria.
So what do you make of the conversation around childhood obesity right now, which sort of dovetails with what you're doing? I mean, the rates are sort of an epidemic in our country, but we also know that those kids face discrimination in their own right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think another part of why Blue Watermelon started, why I feel like I want to take this opportunity to work with kids is because of my own personal journey. I mean, I was overweight by the time I was 10. Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle. It's a struggle to eat well. And I think that if you are given the opportunity to have better food choices and be exposed to better food choices, then that'll continue as you, grow older. And then, I think about, again, going back to my grandmother and all that exposure of like, you know, the fresh
food.
It was there, but I was like, I would literally trade that avocado sandwich to get something
like in the school lunch that was, you know, bad for me.
Yeah.
You know, get the bologna sandwich or whatever.
So those, I mean, those experiences like shape you though. It sounds like.
Oh, it does.
Do you see yourself in a lot of those kids that you work with in this project?
Oh, absolutely. I see the kids that get bullied. I see the kids that are bullies. I see the kids that, you know, are the fear of eating, maybe even the fear of eating around other people. Mm-hmm. I can see all of that. I mean, it's interesting that another chef that was working with me said, you know, she was talking to a group of people and she said, I saw Charlene go to the kid that was by themselves and sit down with them. You know, that's how she is. And it's like, that's how I was in high school. I mean, I remember I wanted to be around the students that were the ones getting picked on and were the ones that maybe had a disability or something like that. Definitely not the cool kids. Those were my friends. You know, I feel those kids when we work with them and try to spend a little extra time with them and make sure they know that they're seen. That's part of what we do with our food too, is like we have different chefs every month coming up with a dish, and we want to make sure that the students with our recipes can feel like maybe something that they're having at home is being seen in the classroom, and that they can be proud of where they're from and their heritage and things like that, and that they can feel seen. It's really important, I think, as a child that you feel that way. The food has all of those ways of touching somebody.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there. That is Chef Charlene Badman, co-owner of F&B, joining us. Thank you so much, Charlene, for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brodian. As I mentioned earlier, it is April Fool's Day, a day historically associated with pranks. The history of April Fools dates back at least as far as the 17th century, when scores of Londoners were invited to the Tower of London for a hoax event billed as the annual Washing of the Lions. Those, of course, were simpler times in many ways, and centuries later, in an increasingly virtual society, it's harder to know who and what information we can trust. Amanda Kerberg studies digital culture at ASU, and as she tells my co-host Sam Dingman, she remembers the first time she fell for an April Fool's prank.
When I was in, I think I was in middle school, I remember like very clearly driving through the cornfields of Indiana with the NPR playing on the radio. And they were doing this whole like in-depth report on how it was a new fashion trend among like very trendy tweens and teens to get their belly buttons removed.
First came belly button rings and tummy tattoos, and now a new trend is showing up on the midsections of America's youth. And for some parents, this may really cause their stomachs to turn over. Some kids, mostly young women, according to the mag Teen Buzz, are getting their navels removed. The fad started, as so many seem to, in Southern California.
I was sitting there with my parents, and I'm in the backseat just going, what is going on? And none of us are questioning this.
Now, knowing a thing or two about the editorial style of public radio, I have to imagine that these reports were delivered in a very probing, intellectually rigorous sort of style, which must have added to the credulousness.
Yes. We decided to find out for ourselves if this procedure is safe. We called Dr. Lucia Stern, a cosmetic surgeon, to find out more about what is officially called a navelectomy.
You know, when I first heard about this procedure, I was really shocked as a physician and as a mother.
Something that's interesting to me about that is I feel like that is markedly different than the pranks you were talking about pulling in high school, where it's like, this is obviously a joke.
Yes.
Whereas something like this report on NPR is, it seems like, sort of purposely playing with the line of credibility.
I think so. Yeah. BBC has done definitely some of the most famous April Fool's pranks. In 1957, they had a fake report, about 3-minute report on the harvesting of spaghetti from trees in Switzerland.
Spaghetti cultivation here in Switzerland is not, of course, carried out on anything like the tremendous scale of the Italian industry. Many of you, I'm sure, will have seen pictures of the vast spaghetti plantation.
And they had to like put out, you know, a pretty big retraction because they got hundreds of phone calls asking where people could buy a spaghetti tree.
The last 2 weeks of March, are an anxious time for the spaghetti farmer. There's always the chance of a late frost, which, while not entirely ruining the crop, generally impairs the flavor and makes it difficult
that,
for him to...
That balance of sincerity and absurdity is just beautifully managed.
But, you know, something that to me is encoded in all of these examples is this idea that a broadcast that comes from the official channel, whether we're talking about National Public Radio or the BBC or, you know, even with something like War of the Worlds, it's like if it is broadcast from an official seeming outlet, it is true. And our starting point ought to be that this is objective truth. And it seems like that is what allowed these places to clown on people in the way that they did.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We don't so much live in that world anymore.
No, we do not.
Obviously, the Trumpism of fake news has a lot to do with that, but it seems like it started before Trump became kind of the self-appointed arbiter of what is real and what is fake when it comes to the news. When would you say that that began?
Well, I mean, as a digital media scholar, I want to be like, well, with digital media, of course. But I was just talking to my students the other day about what a big deal it was when Eisenhower had to come out and say, like, oh, yeah, that plane that went down in the Soviet Union that we told you guys was, you know, a weather balloon and definitely not a spy plane. And all of the mainstream media, you know, believed him because, of course, that was kind of the relationship. That was actually a spy plane.
Ever since the beginning of my administration, I have issued directives to gather in every feasible way the information required to protect the United States and the free world against surprise attacks and to enable them to make effective preparations for defense.
There have been like a lot of moments throughout history that even predate digital media or are the movement of news into platforms that scholars would say are, you know, definitively about entertainment and so kind of can't support this more objective, accuracy-focused sense of journalism to begin with, you know, whether it's television moving into social media platforms and other forms of digital media. But I think, certainly throughout the 20th century, getting into the 21st, we've had this increasing devaluation of the expert. And as we get into these more participatory technologies where we're breaking down boundaries, right? So nobody is just a passive audience member anymore. We're all like talking and sharing and commenting on what we're seeing. And that is part of the performance as much as the performance itself. But what that means is that we don't have this strict delineation of rules anymore. So there isn't this perfect sense of, well, there's this objective journalist who is not a human being like the rest of us that we should all gather around and listen to and not, you know, push back or question.
I had this thought as you were just saying all of that, that it almost seems like what used to be a prank is almost now more of a test.
Yes. Yeah.
To see how much you trust the outlet that you're getting your information from.
Absolutely.
And it's like there's this imperative to like do your own research about everything and make sure you're not being taken in by some sort of bias or something like that. Or at least that's the world that some in the tech community envision for how we take in information.
Yeah. And there's such a paradox to this moment. And I think, you know, speaking of like that role of news organizations, like you say, that finding and establishing that credibility, because it is so much harder now, is so much more vital to the social responsibility theory of the press, to, you know, democracy, functioning society, right? And I think that's really gets to the heart of why, speaking of, NPR did decide not to do these April Fool's pranks anymore, that they just didn't hit in the same way anymore. It wasn't kind of the role of these journalistic institutions to play in this way. Now, brands are still absolutely playing in that space.
I was going to say, though, case in point, you and I are sitting here on public radio having a very serious-minded conversation about pranks rather than pulling a prank. But you were saying about brands.
So like one of the ones that I looked up when I was looking at kind of the history of brands doing April Fool's pranks was Taco Bell in 1996 ran newspaper ads saying that they had purchased the Liberty Bell and it was going to now go by the name the Taco Bell Liberty Bell. Now, that's another one that sounds a little different to our 2025 years.
Yeah. Yeah, could be a matter of time before the Liberty Bell is the Taco Bell Liberty Bell.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you can't trust anything you've heard except this segment today. I've been speaking with Amanda Kerberg, who teaches digital culture at the Cronkite School, who's a PhD candidate at the Cronkite School, and is, of course, our resident pop culture expert here at the show. Amanda, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sam.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.